is for whistleblowers.
Who stand up for the truth and face devastating consequences. Who document facts and risk their lives and livelihoods to bring those facts to the public.
They come from all walks of life, government, science, journalism, academia, and many other fields. They'll be safe, warm, and welcome here on the Whistleblower Newsroom every Friday morning, 10 a.m., right here on
Hi, everyone. I'm Beattie Confretto.
This is Heidi Bogosian, co-host of Love.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. The topic today is economic, and more specifically, it's red flags rising. Okay, what's going on? You hear a lot of official talk here by government and business economists that, we got a recovery going here in the first quarter of 21. As I've said many times, you've got to distinguish a recovery from a rebound. And this is a great recession that began last February, March, a year ago. Great recessions are characterized by rebounds. In other words, short, shallow recoveries followed by relapses, temporary short relapses in terms of economic recovery. Recovery is sustained growth. Rebounds are temporary, and you don't recover the full amount of the activity that was lost in the economy. And you bounce along the bottom with rebounds and relapses. And that goes on for years. And in between, you have a chronic problem of employment. And that's what happened after 2008-09. And I fear we're seeing the same thing again. Or we'll see the same thing again. You can't take short-term rebounds as an indication that you've got a full recovery. We may have a rebound here in the first quarter because they're opening the economy, aren't they? People are getting vaccines and they're jumping the gun and they're saying, hey, you know, let's just reopen everything. To some extent, they have no alternative because businesses are ignoring the shutdown orders and are reopening. And, governments, state governments are saying, okay, you can reopen partially, but businesses are beginning to ignore that. Small businesses in particular in the service sector, they're just reopening. So that reopening, you're going to get some economic activity recovery. And, that's what's happening here. The triple crisis that I've been talking about is always driven by what's the status of the COVID impact, what's the status of the fiscal stimulus, and what's the status of political instability. Well, we've got some relief from the COVID reopening the economy. We've got some relief from the political instability. But political instability has taken another form of bipartisanship. I'll talk about what I mean that shortly. And, of course, we have a little bit of an impact on the economy in January from the $600 checks that were passed at the end of December. But what are these red flags? What are the red flags rising I'm talking about? Well, there's at least a half a dozen or more of them, and let's focus on them. Okay, one, the Federal Reserve this past week passed a report here, And it warned of insolvency risks and growing business bankruptcies. Well, wait a minute. We're doing so well. We're recovering. You know, why are these financial risks, business risks, growing? Insolvency means you're broke. You can't pay your bills. And it looks like that's the condition going forward. You're insolvent. You don't have sufficient funds to survive. That's to be distinguished from what economists call liquidity risk. You just don't have enough money on hand. You know, the Fed can help by providing more liquidity. But if you're insolvent, it doesn't matter what the liquidity risk is. In fact, the banks and other lenders won't give you liquidity if you are insolvent. In other words, looks like you can't get out of it, no matter if we throw good money after bad and give you loans. So insolvency risk is pretty serious. That leads to bankruptcies. And in fact, the Fed talks about the two conditions simultaneously. Growing insolvency risk. For some time, credit was made so easy to business. I'm talking about before COVID hit, that companies that just weren't performing were able to get loans, were able to get financing to stay afloat, even when, you know, by all indicators, they should not have. They should have folded. But when credit is so easy, interest rates so low, these zombie companies, or would-be zombie companies, continue to exist. They're technically insolvent, but liquidity keeps them afloat until you have a crisis. When you have the real crisis, then the liquidity dries up and they sink. That's what insolvency is. We've had an incredible debt run-up, business debt, household debt, government debt now, run-up in the last 10 years. It began under Obama. It accelerated under Trump. You know, remember when Trump came in office, the Fed was trying to raise interest rates in order to recoup some of the excess liquidity it threw at the economy under Obama. But Trump immediately attacked the Fed, and his chair Powell threatened to fire him and everything, got big business behind him, and Powell capitulated and started throwing money into the system again. Throwing all that liquidity in the system generates financial asset bubbles over the intermediate and longer term. Throwing the liquidity saves the system from a crash, but in other words, the solution that saves a financial crash is the same solution that generates the next one, excess liquidity. Excess liquidity gets translated into excess credit and therefore debt. And the more debt you have when the next crisis comes, the more difficult it is to survive. You got to keep financing, paying the principal and interest on that debt. And when you can't, right, you go under. In the crisis, the banks and other lenders won't give you the extra liquidity in order to survive. They figure you're a bad risk. You're going to go under anyway. So they just don't give it to you, and then you go under. So the debt buildup during the good time becomes the problem when the economy is in trouble. Well, the economy has been in real trouble for the past year, you know, but this whole process takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. And we've thrown a lot of credit and debt at businesses, kept rates super low, interest rates. So the borrowing has been free, the lending has been free and easy. But now rates are rising. Yes. rates are rising in the economy. The 10-year and the 30-year Treasury bond are on a tear. The rates are escalating faster and faster. That means that companies that have overloaded themselves with excess debt over the intermediate long term under Obama and Trump, and now especially in the last year, have this huge load of debt and they can't pay it off. And borrowing the money is more and more expensive in order to do it. Oh, it's a problem. It's a big problem for them. Yeah. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. And that's what the Fed is warning about, right? Insolvency risk. Well, it has to do with the excess debt buildup, business debt buildup, especially in certain sectors of the economy. The Fed is raising the red flag and saying, watch out. We have record debt leverage ratios going on in business. And you know what? We got it going on in households, too. Yeah, households. What is it? We got $100 billion in back owed rent. You know, we got 48 million renters. Renter units in this country, and they owe probably about $100 billion. You know, back in December, it was $77 billion, and there's no real rent relief going on. It's probably $100 billion in back rent relief. What about student debt? You know, they have forbearance on student debt, suspended, I think, until April now. How much is that? Well, that's hundreds of billions of dollars of interest owed that's going to be tacked on to the principal that students have to pay. And by the way they work in the government is that you got to pay the principal all off first once you start repaying again. Yeah, so you're, and in the meantime, your interest on the principal that you're not paying. Excuse me, you got to pay the interest rate off first, right? When you start repaying. Meanwhile, the interest on the principal keeps growing. So you're paying interest, paying interest, paying interest. You know, it's over $2 trillion now when you add in parent student loans. $2 trillion owed by students on their debt. Student debt. Mortgage debt, same thing. We had forbearance. We got hundreds of billions of dollars that have to be made up by homeowners. So households are up to their ass and elbows in debt as well as businesses. And then we got government, of course. You know, state and local governments are almost broke, many of them. And the federal government is at, what, $4-5 trillion in debt, total national debt because of this crisis. So all across the board in the three main sectors of the economy, you know, government units and households and businesses, we have this massive debt buildup. Now, debt's not a problem as long as your income is rising and you can pay for the principal and interest on it. That's why debt gets built up during good times. But when you have bad times economically, the economy, the real economy slows down. Well, you don't have the income to pay the higher debt that you accumulated. You don't have the income because prices don't, you can't raise prices during an economic slowdown. And then also the volume of your sales declines sharply as well. So the two main ways businesses raise income are cut off. And the same thing for households. You know, households, most of them, 75,000 annual income below, it's wages. It's their wages. That's their sole source of income. And if you don't have a job, if you're unemployed chronically, well, that household income, wage income collapses. And of course, that's what's happened. And even those who have jobs, you know, if their hours of work get cut, it's the same thing. They don't have enough income. The service, in other words, pay the principal and interest on their debt load that accumulated during the previous period. And the same thing with government. You know, when you have an economic recession and contraction, tax income, tax revenues decline sharply, i.e. government doesn't have the income. But, you know, government has the added possibility that it can just print the money if it needs to be, right? Or it can try to get foreigners to buy more of its debt, issue treasury bonds, by raising interest rates, right? That attracts foreign buyers of U.S. treasuries, bigger return for them. That attracts it. But raising interest rates slow the domestic economy in the U.S. So it's a contradiction there, you see. So massive debt has been accumulated and topped off here in the past year for all three sectors. And now the question is, how do you pay for it? You know, well, if you're a zombie company, the Fed's identifying, you can't. You don't. If you can't sell and raise prices, how are you going to pay for the excess debt that you've accumulated? Oh, well, you either have to do one of a couple things, right? You got to borrow more money. Well, at a certain point, as I said, the banks don't want to give you any more because you're bad risk of being insolvent. So you can't get money there. You got to sell off some of your assets to your company. But if you're a company, you know, that's not well positioned, no one wants to buy your bad assets. But if you have good assets, you sell off the best ones. And that long term puts you even greater risk. So if you can't refinance your debt, you know, with a lender, you got to start selling off parts of the company, and that's the death knell. And you're going to go under at some point. Once you start selling off, too, the banks definitely won't lend you any money. It's very clear what's happening to you. Maybe a private equity firm will come and buy you up and sell parts of you off and throw the rest under the bus. Anyway, record debt leverage. And you know where, what are the areas that are most at risk here in this excess debt? Well, I think it's a lot of these high-yield debt, junk bond debt companies that are loaded up on junk bonds, you know, retail companies, you know, entertainment companies, you know, like movie chains and so forth, retail like Penny's and some of, you know, big box retail, and commercial property real estate, I think is a big risk. You know, the crash of 2008 was driven by residential property real estate, right? Housing, residential housing was, you know, at the center of that. Well, I think it's quite possible that the center of the next one will be commercial real estate. Well, what's that? Well, office buildings, yeah, hotels, casinos, theme parks, malls of all kinds. These are all commercial real estate. And they've been hit. All those sectors have been hit real hard. They're not going to survive. They're not going to come out of this, a lot of them. Some of them are going to insolvent, go under. Yeah. You know, other investors may buy up some of them, like the malls, and convert them into something else. And the office sector, office building sector, you know, is going to take a little time to enter the crisis, but it's happening because of remote work and a lot of people just getting the hell out of the cities, right? Big demand for suburban and exurban residential housing for those who are able to work from home. They're getting out of the cities. Well, the prices are too damn high there anyway. And that's where you catch COVID worse than anywhere else, right? And people know by now that, you know, these waves are of, you know, virus, pandemics, they're not going away. You know, we've had three of them so far in just 20 years, you know. There'll be others, and they seem to occur every 5 to 10 years. So people are getting the hell out of the cities, moving out of the cities. Well, that means you got a lot of empty office buildings, and the owners of those office buildings are in trouble. Longer, intermediate term, not even long term. They'll go the way of the malls and the hotels. So commercial property, real estate, watch it. Especially these companies called real estate investment trusts, REITs, REIT, real estate investment trusts, which owned a lot of these properties, commercial properties, they're going to be in trouble. And the problem is when companies default on their payments, on their debt payments, right? It precipitates a chain reaction among other companies that have loaned them money that can't collect now. And those companies get in trouble for others, you know, because all these financial institutions have lend money to each other. It's a big web of lending out there. And a chain reaction can occur and often does when a big one goes under, you see. Got to take a big one going under. Well, the Fed is meeting and central banks are all meeting next week. It'll be interesting to see what they have to say in their minutes, which we won't see for another month or so, about this insolvency risk and bankruptcies rising. You know, the Fed puts out a report like this because not only as a warning sign, but as a indication of what it's thinking and talking about. But long-run bond rates, 10-year and 30-year treasuries are rising fast. That's a big warning sign. Yeah. And then Powell's the chairman of the Fed, the central bank, has indicated he's going to keep the liquidity flowing because of the risks, you see. Others are warning, oh, that's going to mean inflation. And Powell said that, okay, but inflation will be transitory here. You know, inflation in what is the question? In real goods and services, inflation, you know, food and housing, right? Inflation in you know, non-durables spending or in durables, you know. What inflation or inflation in financial markets, which, you know, when they talk about, oh, inflation risk, they conveniently don't talk about bubbles, financial asset bubble, price bubbles, inflation, right? Well, that's really been going on. We haven't had any, you know, much inflation in real goods and services. But they use this, the government running a deficit and debt means big deficits means going to be inflation. Well, there's no evidence of that whatsoever for decades now. But they still use that argument, you see, to try to shoot down social program spending. They don't use the argument when they're raising war defense spending. And they don't raise the argument of, oh, deficits are a problem when they cut taxes for wealthy investors and corporations. No, it's not a problem then. It's only a problem when you're spending on social programs. Then it's inflationary, right? But there's no evidence of that. But yet, you know, that old argument keeps popping up. Oh, deficits are going to cause inflation. Too much government spending overheats the economy. No, too much government lending overheats the financial markets. And that's been going on for decades now. As I said, too much liquidity by the central banks produces financial asset price bubbles and it leads eventually to a financial crash. And the solution by the central banks is to throw more liquidity at it to prevent companies from going under. Well, that solves the short-term problem, but adds to the longer-term problem and the next bubble and crash. The solution to the crisis short-term becomes the problem of the crisis renewing longer-term. That's a fundamental fact of 21st century finance capitalism. They keep it going by stoking the fires. And when the crash comes, they throw more at it. And, you know, they talk about, oh, the Fed will take the liquidity back out of the economy. It never does, because it can't. Okay, so first red flag, summarized, the Fed warns of insolvency risk and bankruptcies rising. What's the second flag? Second flag is this chronic problem of more than a million new jobless unemployment claims filed every week since October. Every week since October, more than a million people filing for benefits. In other words, newly unemployed. It's pretty steady, around 850,000 every week, new filings since October, just for the state program. You know, the traditional state unemployment benefits program. Then we got the federal PUA, you know, pandemic unemployment assistance for freelancers and others. On top of that, of several 200,000-300,000. So we've been running about 1.1-1.2 million every week for 5 months now. Is that an indication of recovery? I don't think so. Well, wait a minute. Manufacturing's been rising, right? Housing's been rising, right? But not the jobs in those sectors. Businesses are learning, as they do in every recession, how to get along with less employment. They figure out ways, you know, the recession kind of forces them to figure out ways of, well, how can we keep our output level with fewer people? And, you know, when the economy does better rebounds, they hire some back, but they don't hire them all back. You see, they leave some of them out there. And every time you have a recession, you have that process. You also have the process every time there's a recession of hiring back more and more people as temporaries and part-timers. That way they don't have to pay benefits, you see. Health benefits, pension benefits. So every cycle of a recession, people are laid off in big numbers, and they're not all recalled back. And a residue is left out there. And on top of that, those who are called back at lower pay and benefits. And over time, you get this accumulation of unemployed out there and people just giving up and dropping out of the labor force. So over a million since October. Red flag, doesn't seem to be going away. An indication that the labor markets are more and more divorced from the real economy, just as the financial markets are more and more divorced. You know, economists are predicting first quarter, you know, a GDP increase of 4%, 5%. It may not mean anything if you still got a million people every week filing for benefits. You know, officially they admit that there's like 19 million people on benefits right now. Well, that doesn't count the 4 million plus who have dropped out of the labor force. So you got to add them to it. And it doesn't count, you know, the 1 to 2 million people who are on furloughs or have had to, quote, quit their job in order to do homeschooling. You know, we got to talk about this homeschooling thing. I mean, this really has to end. You know, the working class, particularly minority working class, are really being whacked. you know, by this homeschooling thing. I mean, you know, remote learning thing. It just doesn't work. You know, maybe upscale white kids, you know, who have, you know, good Wi-Fi in their home and, you know, they all have computers and so forth. But, you know, a lot of black and brown kids just don't have that. And they haven't been to school at all. Yeah. You know, I often wondered why we're not hearing about the private schools, whether the infection, what's the infection rate in the private schools? Because they've been back, you know, private elementary schools, they've been back in school. You know, if the infection rate is not all that great, you know, in those private schools, why are we keeping the public schools closed? Well, to some extent, it's a legitimate concern, you know, by all teachers, particularly older teachers of, you know, maybe catching something. Although it's, you know, it's pretty clear you don't get much transmission from the very young. But, you know, once they get vaccinated, there's no excuse not to go back. You know, look, you know, some teachers probably like it. They don't have to commute, right? They don't have to commute. They don't have to do full lesson plans. They're only teaching half a day remotely. They don't have to do all the grading that they used to do. Hey, it's a pretty nice deal, all this remote learning for some of them. I mean, there's some of that going on, and you know the unions can't go against that significant segment of their membership if they don't want to return. So, you know, you got this problem, really. Kids got to get back to school. Well, I guess I fall in that camp because, you know, the impact on the working class is so severe, particularly the minority working class. You know, it's been a lost year for them. Okay, so that's a digression. Let's get back to the red flags rising. Jobless claims, yeah, don't seem to be abating at all. Chronic. Over a million every week filing. I mean, it boggles the mind when you think about it, right? And, you know, last week or the week before last, you know, you got this big, you know, media theme that, you know, the jobless claims are declining. You know, what did they go down 30, 40,000 maybe to, you know, 790,000 or something like that instead of 830,000. But they went back up this week and they revised the previous week up by 50,000. So there was no decline in jobless claims. But they really pump up, the mainstream media really pumps up any short-term indication of a shift, you see. But you got to look at longer-term trends here. All right, so let's talk about retail sales. Well, here's another one of the week, you know, the positive data of the week that's really getting a big spin here in the media. Yeah, okay, so retail sales in January rose 5% for the month. Significant. Oh, but you got to realize, you know, that follows 3 months of consecutive decline in retail sales, October, November, December. So, you know, they're recovering some of that. And then you get big sales after the holidays, and there's some spending going on. But the real thing that's driving January retail sales is the $600 checks finally hit the economy from the, you know, mitigation subsidy bill that was passed at the end of December, the $900 billion, you know, of $600 checks and continuing unemployment benefits until the middle of March. Yeah, that hit the economy. And statistics show that if you're earning $75,000 a year in annual income and below, in other words, the core of the working class, then you spent 88% of that $600 within 2 weeks. Shows how desperate people are, you know? They spend it immediately. So $600 is nothing. Now, conversely, if you look at people earning six figures over 100,000 They hoarded most of those checks. They didn't spend it because they don't need to, you see? They don't need to. They got big savings. The people under 75,000 are the folks, you know, the 80 million in this country who have $400 or less in savings. They have nothing they can fall back on. So when they get to $600, boy, they spend it quick. But those over 100,000, they don't need it, and they hoard it. Or they pay down their personal debt. Retail sales continued to contract for that group, rising sharply for those under 75,000. And you can see the confirmation of that in credit card spending. Credit card spending rising for people under 75,000 a year and slowing for people making six figures. Yeah, the working class is desperate. That's, in my opinion, retail sales show this big problem. And that is really a boost due to one-time checks and unemployment benefits. And if they don't quickly get the checks that they promised, they meaning the Democrats, and extend the unemployment benefits here quickly, we will see a relapse in retail sales, I believe. They better do it quick, but it's pretty clear that Biden and the Democrats are really looking at passing this legislation mid to late March, because the $900 billion passed in December runs out in the middle of March. So they're looking to tag it to the end of that stimulus, whatever comes out of the $1.9 trillion, and I don't believe it'll be anywhere near $1.9 trillion. Whatever comes out of that, you know, will only begin in the latter half of March. So you're not going to see any additional checks for a couple months here, which to me means retail sales, you know, are not going to continue this 5% per month bounce. Okay, so retail sales, red flag. Jobless claims, red flag. Fed warning of insolvency risk, red flag. Financial bubbles, red flag. What do I mean by that? Well, just look at the stock market. Up and up and up. Yeah. And now we've got this speculation, financial speculation peaking in some ways. Well, look what's happened to Bitcoin and cryptos. Bitcoin, $50,000 per coin. Well, what does that represent? Well, that's represent chasing yield by investors. In other words, other financial sectors have topped out and investors are going after even more risky investments. You know, like GameStop. Remember GameStop? We talked about that here. You know, GameStop's really reflected of a zombie company, you know, with a product that's dead in the water, that's being simply, you know, stoked by speculative demand for its stock. In other words, the market's being manipulated by those with money. Drive prices up or drive it down if you're a hedge fund, right? Flip it, make a big capital gain. And when you got so much liquidity as an investor out there, easy to get the money, cheap money everywhere, you take big risks. You know, traditionally, the speculative demand used to be for junk bonds, you know, high-yield junk bonds and gold futures and so forth, commodity futures. But that's not really where the money is going. It's passed that by, and it's going to even higher, riskier areas of the financial economy. And, you know, that's options trading and Bitcoin and cryptos and so forth. The money's flowing into those sectors. junk bond sectors, gold sectors, oil, you know, it's not going there anymore where typically it has. It's even riskier now. And, you know, as bad as the stock market bubbles are, you know, who's driving these bubbles? Well, half of all stock purchases are totally opaque. In other words, the big investors don't go and buy in the open market. No, they invest, they buy stocks, sell stocks, and so forth in dark pools. Special customers get to buy, and no one knows who they are and what they're buying. Dark pools. Over half of all the stock trades are in dark pools now. And then we have this thing called SPACs, S-P-A-C, you know, special purpose access something here. Yeah, SPACs, right? Special purpose acquisition companies, acronym. What is that? Oh, well, that's rich people throwing their money into a SPAC, not even knowing what it's going to invest in. Even before it invests, you know, that's like a blind trust hedge fund or something like that. And it's an indication that you know, they're taking bigger and bigger risks, chasing yield. Well, you know, Congress had a hearing on short sellers. We've talked about what short sellers are. These are just extreme financial speculators, right? Betting that a stock is going to fall and then letting the market know that you had a big bet, which drives down the stock. Oh, you know, somebody's betting big that stock and GameStop is going to fall. Well, let's all jump in. You know, they it's a way of manipulating the market, short selling, and driving down, increasing your bet, driving down the value, the price of the stock, and increasing your bet. That's what short selling is. That's what the hedgies are doing, you see. These are the same guys who gave us the collapse of these financial institutions in 2008, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Washington Mutual, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, all those that collapsed at the time. They collapsed because of the short sellers. The short sellers precipitated the crash of 2008. And then, of course, it spread to other markets, derivatives, you know, AIG, insurance company, and so forth. It just went from one sector to the other. But, you know, they just marched, drove down the price of these stocks. And if your company, your stock price is falling, you can't raise money by issuing more stock. Who wants to buy stock price stock that's falling in price, right? Who wants to lend money to a company whose stock is collapsing? They can't get liquidity in order to survive. They go under. Oh, and then the derivative bettors make money as well when they go under, you see. It's all a big casino. But when you precipitate a financial crash, you cause a psychological effect throughout the economy, the real economy as well. And everything comes down. Well, I think we're heading for something here. You know, late 2021, maybe 2022, in terms of a financial instability event. Yeah, well, the next bubble will probably be oil. Oil futures. Financial instruments, oil futures, right? Watch these oil companies and energy companies going to use the weather problem in Texas as an excuse, there already are, to drive up prices for oil and its derivatives, gasoline, so forth. Yeah, they're going to use that. They're already doing it. Using an excuse to jack up the price. Yeah. Commodity bubbles. You know, the speculative parade is going to march on from Bitcoins and GameStop over to oil and commodity bubbles. Watch for that. Right? Okay, another red flag is China introduced its own digital currency this past week. Yeah. China's getting the jump on digital currencies. You know, Bitcoin's digital currency, right? Cryptos. Well, it's official government issuing its own. It's a way of creating liquidity. China, you know, wants to issue its own and get all these buyers of Bitcoin and so forth to buy its own digital currency as a way of raising money for investing, you know, in its economy. You know, what these digital currencies mean is that the central banks are going to lose further control of the global money supply. It's already their control of it is seriously risky. And now digital currencies are going to generate even more problem in terms of money supply. Well, if China's central bank, People's Bank of China, is doing it, the Fed's going to do it. And so is, you know, the ECB, European Central Bank, and Bank of England, so Bank of Japan, they're all going to do it. China is forcing them to accelerate the introduction of official government digital currency. Oh, it's even more liquidity now, right, being generated, and harder to control because it's all out there in the ether world, you know, the internet, and it's easy to hack. Well, it's also going to stimulate competition between central banks in creating excess money supply, digital currency. Big risk here. Well, that also means that the central banks and the governments are going to have to regulate private cryptos more and tax it. I think that's going to cause these bubbles in Bitcoin and everything once that occurs to unravel. But as to when that will happen, it's hard to tell. Okay, so China's introduction of digital currency, another red flag, implications, consequences of which are hard to really predict at the moment, but they will be significant. Another red flag, Biden, bipartisan backtracking. Yeah, the typical Democrat stuff, right? They promised $2,000 checks. Oh, maybe we'll get $1,400 someday. Maybe. Or some of us will at some point. Maybe. Well, they quickly backtracked on that, didn't they? Well, the other backtracking is going on as well, you know. What did Biden do the past week? Or maybe it was even the week before. Well, he squashed the whole idea of $15 minimum wage before the House even passed it. You know, he publicly gave the signal. Oh, you know, $15. And by the way, that $15 wasn't immediate. That $15 was over 5 years, a little bit each year over 5 years. You know, current is federal minimum wage, $7.25. And if you work in a restaurant, it's only $2. An hour. So he's already said, oh, no, I'm not for, you know, it probably won't pass. Well, you know, he said that after he met with a whole group of big corporate CEOs. And they told him, oh, no, we can't have a $15 minimum wage. And he quickly backed off of that. Right? You know, a lot of progressives keep complaining, and justifiably, you know, about the backtracking on the $2,000 checks, $1,400 checks, you know, that's $600 less. Yeah.
Hello.
Well, how much is that? How much is that? Well, you're talking about less than $200 billion when you cut out $600. I think it's like $150-some billion it's worth, $600 of checks. Oh, that's what, as I said, stimulated retail sales in January, $600, $150-some billion. Well, compare that to the minimum wage. You know, if you've had a $15 minimum per hour minimum wage, you know, that's $8 more roughly above the $7.25 that now exists. 27 million Americans would get the boost, would get the minimum wage boost. And if you figure they work 2,000 hours a year, which is, you know, typical full-time work, you know, $8 times 27 million times 2,000 hours, you know, is, guess what? $432 billion a year. Yeah, the minimum wage, if fully implemented, would be, given the working class, $432 billion more compared to $150 billion with $600 checks. I mean, we really should be railing about, you know, I'm not saying don't complain about the backtracking on the checks, but, you know, the big thing is the minimum wage. And Biden's abandoned it already before the negotiations have begun. He signaled, you know, oh, I don't think we can afford it. Oh, Obama reincarnated. He also, Biden also, backtracking on student debt relief, right? Remember they said, oh, you know, $10,000 and others like Warren and Sanders saying, no, $50,000. Well, he's already signaled he doesn't think that's possible. They're already backtracking on student debt relief. Right? And, of course, we're in the middle of the negotiations here over the fiscal stimulus bill, the $1.9 trillion, which is mostly social program spending, although there's hundreds of billions more, once again, for small businesses after they got $282 billion in December and $600 and some billion in March, small businesses. And now they're not even making a pretense of a loan that has to be repaid. They're just giving it to small businesses. Yeah. And that's in, you know, hundreds of billions or more, a couple hundred billion more, I think, in the Biden $1.9 trillion. Yeah. But watch. Before it's over, the $1.9 trillion fiscal bill will cut out a lot of the spending that was earmarked for state and local governments. $490 billion of that was earmarked for state and local governments. Hundreds of billions more for extending unemployment benefits through next September. Rent assistance, child care subsidy increases. You know, watch all that being cut back. I still believe, as I've said, that the final bill will be somewhere around $1.1 to $1.5 trillion, probably closer to $1.1. And I'll bet you that the Democrats lose their backbone and don't go budget reconciliation where all they need is 50 plus one. You know, I think Biden's making all these promises to McConnell and others that, we'll compromise with you guys, bipartisan. Yeah. Bipartisan backtracking. Biden's bipartisan backtracking. Nice alliteration there, isn't it? Right? Another thing you're going to see is he signaled he's going to start letting the tech companies hire H-1B visa foreigners. You know, in the last year, Trump put a freeze on that. Well, he'll open that freeze and... you know, we won't let, poor workers in the country from Latin America. But, boy, we sure let the wealthy workers in from Asia. Yeah. H-1B visas, L-1, L-2 visas, managers and so forth. Yeah. Well, hundreds of thousands a year are allowed in on H-1B visas. And once they're in, you know, they are easy on the fast track for citizenship if they want to. But the poor ones, you know, from Latin America, no, we can't let them in. No. So H-1B visas, watch that. Yeah. He'll open that up for tech company buddies. So, red flags. Watch. Biden bipartisan backtracking, red flag. We're seeing more and more indications of that. The checks, minimum wage, student debt, visas, and watch for cutbacks in the $1.9 trillion. If we don't get a significant stimulus out of this, you know, where we're not going to get over the hump, and the economy will get a little rebound in the summer as it opens up even more now with the vaccines. You know, although you got to watch for the South African thing. The vaccines don't work with the South African variant mutation. You know, they seem to work with the UK mutation, but there are, you know, 7 or 8 mutations out there. So what happens with viruses? They keep mutating. They're going to have to come up with a booster shot here for the South African problem. Okay, so, you know, the triple crisis, watch the South African variant. You know, if that gets a foothold here, it'll have an effect on the economy. You know, watch if they cut too much out of the 1.9 stimulus here. You know, political instability. Well, it's now muted, right? We got a little respite here for the next couple of years. But it's all taking the form of Republican Party political instability. You know, the instability has been focused away from U.S. and Congress and institutions, you know, onto the Republican Party. You know, the Cheneys versus the Greens, the McConnells now versus the Trumps. Fight for the Republican Party is going to intensify. We'll see where that goes. But, you know, it's the crisis. The political parties are realigning. It takes years for that to do so, but they're realigning here under the crisis, the threat of the crisis. And that's what we're facing here. Finally, you know, another red flag. Factory manufacturing activity is slowing, still growing, but slowing. And residential construction here slowing as interest rates rise, and the trade deficit growing. Watch all those. Okay, so to summarize, wrap up here, red flags rising, the Fed warning of insolvency risk and bankruptcies, jobless claims chronically continue, well over 1 million a week, retail sales get a little bump, but that's because of the checks, and if the new checks don't come, the bump disappears. Financial bubbles and chasing yield by investors more and more. China introducing its digital currency. What does that mean for central bank monetary policy going forward? Biden bipartisan backtracking, increasing indications, and the growth sectors of the economy, factory and residential housing, slowing. Okay, so let's keep our eye on all that here, particularly the outcome of the $1.9 trillion. Very, very important. And how fast they can get people vaccinated and back to school and open the economy. Very important. And then watch what's going on politically. Political instability will raise its ugly head once again before 2022. Okay, that's it for the day. I'm out of here.
Does PRN inspire you? Does PRN make you want to learn more? Does PRN help you to see inside yourself, to be yourself, to grow, and to do? The truth is, we all need each other to be, to grow, and to do. So, we're asking that you check out the PRN.fm.